alcoholic, drug addict, for all you NA people and cocaine anonymous people. I'm really pleased to be here. It's a real honor. You know, I got 40 minutes to talk, and I'll talk for all 40 minutes, I promise. I just kind of gathered my head for a second. I just flew in last night at midnight. I worked all night till 6:30 in the morning. I went to sleep. I got up. I worked again. Then I came right here. So I'm a little spun in the head. But and then I saw her in the grocery store last night in the middle of the night, which was totally weird. And she was asking me all these questions, which I said I will not answer until I am here. And then, you know, I want to say that I appreciate Haldor, you know, inviting me out. And it's great to be here with my friend, a guy I sponsor, Morton, and the brother of some other crazy sponsee of mine in Copenhagen, or in Denmark. This guy is out of his mind. I mean, I can't imagine how sick you are being related to him. No problem. But anyways, I'm in good company with my fellows here. And, you know, before I get into my talk, I always like to mention a couple of really quick things that some people want to know. I've been sober 28 years. I got sober when I was 17 years old. And the reason I'm still sober today isn't because I've done anything really cool or special. I didn't find the new AA or the inside track or the special, you know, special program, if you will. I did what other people have done, and I followed the suggested outline that you might see in any of your basic texts, whether it's, you know, Cocaine Anonymous, which usually uses AA's basic text because they can't think of one. or NA, which I got a lot of respect for because I think they're pretty good on their signals of purpose. But the bottom line is this, is that, you know, I'm sober today because I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I participate in the program that I primarily go to. If you primarily go to NA or another program, then the key is not talking about it. It's not even acting like you're going to go there. It's in doing it. You know, and working the steps and having a sponsor. And the reason I've been sober as long as I have isn't because of anything special. You know, I got sober, you know, I was a ward of the state that I lived in Arizona. I mean, I wasn't like, oh, I was in trouble with the law, we're just going to put him in jail for a while. My parents gave me to the state and said, you can own him. So, and, you know, and when I got sober, you know, I wasn't on, you know, in the States they have like what they call probation, which is you're, you know, you're like Haldor or something where you're kind of a fuck up, but not that much. then you might be more severe. I don't know everybody in the room, but I'm sure you got people that have been in much more serious problems. They get on what they call parole. And that's when you've been institutionalized for a period of time. And then the state keeps a much closer eye on you. That's what happened to me. Because when I was a ward of the state, I was institutionalized, you know, and I spent a lot of time in jail, you know. And the reason why I mention that is that, you know, even though I spent a lot of time with my freedom taken away from me, it still didn't stop me from drinking and smoking tons of non-habit form marijuana, you know, and doing drugs and everything else, you know. It didn't stop me from any of that. And I always like to talk a little bit about what it was like, because when I got to AA, you know, I didn't come here Mr. Sobriety, you know, and I didn't identify with the guy who was up there talking about how spiritual his life was. You know, what I could relate to is that lunatic sounds a lot like me, and that made me feel more comfortable and like I was in the right place. So I'm going to qualify a little bit on that note. You know, and just in case, there's a good friend of mine that sometimes comes out here and talks. He claims Mickey Bush. And you can tell him he's an asshole for Matt Hainer. So I just wanted that known, Mickey. But in any event, you know, before I started drinking, you know, I had, you know, I had problems at home, you know, but nothing severe. You know, I had a pretty good childhood. I grew up in the state of Michigan, and then I moved to Northern California, back to Michigan, Northern California, back to Michigan, and then to Arizona. And then all hell broke loose. And, you know, moving from Northern California to Michigan is like flying from here to Boston. You know, it's a long haul. And every time I moved, it sucked because it took me away from all my friends and everything I knew. And, you know, my mom at the time was going to AA, and I didn't understand what AA was, but she was going. And there'd be, she'd say, drinking's bad. Your brother Chris, he's wrecked all these cars and relationships, and you don't want to end up like him. And I'd go, oh, yeah, it seems like a bad thing. So intellectually, I sort of knew, like, drugs and alcohol and all that stuff were not going to be good. You know, let's say on paper they were a bad idea. But when I got to Arizona, I started running with a bunch of guys that were a lot like me. You know, and a lot of them were, you know, they had problems at home. And they had older brothers that would drink. And, you know, and I finally started running with a bunch of guys. Now, around here, you got plenty of bridges because I know of all the waterways. But in Arizona, it's all desert. So there's not many bridges because it's hard to dig. But I did find a bridge to drink under the first time. So I got under a bridge with me and my friends, and I was on a girl's three-speed bike, and I had brown OP corduroy shorts on and a 1980s, like, cool guy shirt with a big sailboat across the front. And I remember going down there, and we had a 12-pack of Mickey's Big Mouths. I don't know if you ever drink Mickey's around here, but it's like the shitty beer with the big opening at the top so you can drink it fast. But so I drank 8 Mickey's. They drank 4. And then I came up from under the bridge, and I felt real good. Now, I wasn't filled with this great sense of confidence. I don't know what it was, but I remember going to the local hangout where all my friends were, and feeling pretty confident, though. I did feel pretty good, because I still remember I had my pinky finger through the belt loop of my shorts, and I was blabbering at these girls drunk, and I felt like, oh, I'm rolling here, you know? And somebody came along and said, we got more beer, and I said, more beer, bring it on. And so I drank a couple of Coors, and then somebody said, we got pizza, bring that on too. Bad idea. So, I ate the pizza on top of all that beer, and I got really sick, and I started puking in front of all the girls I was trying to impress. A habit that repeated itself over and over again. Drinking. Now, I don't know about any of you guys, but I'm a regular puker. I would puke at anything, you know. I would go out and do drugs and drink all night long, and I would just make myself throw up. And it doesn't work when you take hallucinogens, by the way. You take acid, you're done. You know, you're in. Because I tried that, like, I puked and I go lay down on mom's lap. Mom, I don't feel good. I'm like 15 years old. She's like, what's going on here? And, I was crazy. But point is that, I started puking and I had to go home. Now, at that time, you know, because I didn't have a car, I was just a young punk, you know, I had to ride my bicycle home. So I remember riding my bicycle home, and the only thing that would keep me upright was the momentum of the bike going forward. And I'm sure some of you in the room can relate to that. Because you maybe can't walk so good, but if you just get a couple of pedals in, the bike straightens out, and you can hang on, and it kind of goes. And that's what happened. You know, I remember I was almost home, and I crashed on a curb, and I was laying there, and I was, all these fire ants are biting my ass, and I'm getting bitten by insects, and I can see my house. It's like from here to the end of this parking lot out there, and I'm thinking maybe I'll stay out here tonight on the grass. But I got up, brushed the bugs and puke off me, and I went inside. And this is like the first time I had to be accountable to somebody, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of younger people in the room can relate to this, where I had to look in and I saw my parents sitting inside. And I was, you know, like, I was all shitty, you know, and I opened my eyes up as wide as I could, and I marched in the door straight. I said, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, I'm feeling pretty tired. I think I'm just going to go to bed. Good night. And I kind of tried to make my way up the steps, and I remember trying to get up the steps, and I was, like, barely moving, and I kind of saw the bed and fell onto it. And later that night, my dad came in the room, and he's like, I could barely hear, Matt, what's wrong? And I was on, and I don't know about you guys, but I was always coming up with great stories because I'm a juvenile, delinquent, thieving scumbag. So I could always come up with some pretty good stories about what was wrong. And I thought, well, I ate some bad food, and that's what I'm going to tell my dad, and that's why I got puke all over me, etc. all I came out of my mouth was I ate a bad donut, and that was it. And I got up the next day, and he's like, you know, you shouldn't do that. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But you know what? The thing is that I was only interested in one thing, getting them off my back. And that feeling that I felt between when I came up from the bridge and I really embarrassed myself felt pretty good, you know? And you'd think... After all the shit that my mom had told me about drinking and all the stuff I'd seen on TV and all this other stuff, I'd, you know, want to not go back and start doing that stupid shit again. But I did, you know, and inside of just a few short years, you know, I did everything the basic text of AA talks about, you know, in the family afterward. You know, I abused my mother. I hit her. And that was a hard thing to deal with. My brother and I were really good friends when we were kids, and when I got done with my drinking and using, we weren't good friends anymore. And it says in the book, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead, you know, and that's exactly what it was in my case, a long period of reconstruction. And I went through, like 4 different high schools, and then I eventually became institutionalized as a ward of the state of Arizona. You know, and each time, you know, they talk about the progression of alcoholism or the progression of drug addiction. And for me, it was getting progressively worse very, very quickly. And I was doing crazy things. I don't know about you guys, but between drinks, I was a complete asshole. You know, I was irritable, restless, and discontented. You know, I would lash out at people. I would just become so dangerously antisocial that, you know, I think people would rather see me drunk or high than have to deal with me without anything because I was just raw. You know, I just hurt all over. And I remember doing crazy things, you know, and I don't know if you relate to this, but I'd like to talk about these because it reminds me of how insane I was. One example was my dad, who is 250 pounds, a big man, and I'm a little skinny shit of a kid, like 120 pounds, maybe 30. I'm out there yelling at my dad at the top of my lungs, "You fat asshole, if you weren't so fat, you could come catch me. I dare you to come catch me." I'd be ducking and weaving and making him chase me around the yard, just sending the guy into a fury. You know. And one day I came home, and he's like, "Where do you think you're going?" And I was in a bad mood because I was out of drugs and I was out of alcohol. And I said, "You know, none of your fucking business." Pardon my profanity. And, you know, and he's like, he just had enough. I could see him starting to erupt. And I thought, all right, I'm going to make the front door. It's all going to be good. I'm going to tell him to go F off, and that's cool. And then I didn't make the front door. He was in front of that stairway too fast. I had to run back up the steps. And I remember as I'm getting into my room, I'm trying to get the ski pole underneath the doorknob so he can't blast down the door. And just as I'm about to get there, he comes flying to the door. Ski pole goes flying. My brother's on the bed. He grabs the ski pole, beating me over the head with a ski pole. Now, I want to just tell you this. Now, I think the average person would probably take the beating and deal with it. But out of the corner of my eye, I could see the window was open. I was 2 stories up. And I always kind of wanted to try this anyways. So I kind of leaped to my feet, and I ran straight for the window. I didn't think twice about it. I just dove right out, hoping something beautiful was going to happen. You know? And I hit my ankle on the way out, and I just kind of went like this. You know, straight down. And I remember my, I was okay, but my dad, he comes, you know, I could see him, he's looking over the side of the window, the ski pole in his hand, and I'm laying down there, "I hate you, old man." And he's like, "I'll throw this at you." And I think he was more relieved I was still alive than anything. But I hobbled off. But the point is that, you know, a sane person wouldn't do that. You know, and in the back of my mind, I kind of wanted to do it. It's crazy. But, you know, there was a lot of situations like that where I would tell my sister, who loved me, who wanted the best for me, and I'd tell her, "I swear to you, Mary Pat, I will never steal your moped again. Just let me take it up to the store for some soda. It's really hot out." She's like, "Okay." Bam, I'm gone for 2 weeks. You know, I would compulsively lie to my family. So one day the moped was chained to the front yard, and I was never going to get it again. But, you know, all kinds of crazy things. You know, blackouts. I didn't drive much because of my age, but what I did drive, I consistently wrecked. Bicycles, I wrecked. Skateboards, I wrecked. Mopeds, I wrecked. I even stole a big tractor one time. Me and all my friends, we were driving down the street. I even wrecked that. It was a big street cleaner that they left the keys in because they thought no moron would steal a street cleaner. I stole the street cleaner. You know? So it was bad, you know? And eventually, all this shit I'm talking about, all my petty theft, all of it caught up with me. And they finally got me in front of the judge and they were like, this guy is a fuck up. And my parents were like, we would be pleased if you would take him off our hands for a while. So I was like, yeah, go to hell. I'm going to go to jail. I'll be all right. You know, I'll be fine. You know, and I went to jail. And I thought I'd be all right. You know, and I was in there for a little while. And then I realized I'm not getting out anytime soon. And then I became a born-again Christian in jail. And I was like, you know, quoting the Bible, making deals with Jesus, speaking in tongues, leading other guys through Scripture. I mean, I was out of my mind. And I remember I went to court, and my dad was sitting up there, and they were thinking about letting me come back home. And I was like, you are the devil incarnate, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm kind of yelling at him. And he's like, just go ahead and keep him. So I went to the boys' prison big house, and then I sat in there for a while. And the thing is that, like, I want to say that probably like a lot of you in here, the fog cleared. You know, I started to get my confidence back. I could remember how to multiply and divide and subtract. Literally, I could not do that when I got in jail. I just was like, I'd look at the numbers and go, I can't do it. And I wasn't like one of these guys who would get high a lot and eat. I was the guy who would get high a lot, go to the refrigerator hungry, but couldn't decide what to eat. So I would shut the door and go get high again. You know, and that's what I would do. So I'm in jail and I get out. Now, I want to just mention that, you know, I was smart enough to know that I didn't want that again. I didn't want to have to be let out of my room to take a piss. You know, I didn't want to have to be let out of my room to have any recreation. I wanted my freedom. It was precious to me, you know, and I knew that, you know, if I don't make more mistakes, I'm going to end up going back to jail. Well, of course I did because I'm an alcoholic, you know. I'm a drug addict. You know, and we have the ability to get, as they say in the basic text of AA, getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. I was getting tight all the time and making mistakes. So I ended up hitchhiking through the center of male prostitution in Phoenix, Arizona, thinking nobody would really seedy would pick me up. Of course, some guy picked me up and said, do you want a party? And my instant answer was, yes, I do. So he took me to the bad side of town. And started feeding me booze, and this is the one time I literally think that alcoholism saved my ass, because, you know, I got drank all of this booze, then I got up, and I went out and stole another bottle of whiskey. I came back, drank that, then I stood up again, and I was always getting more booze for all my lame friends that were never around. And he's like, okay, sure. And any minute he's like, you know, this kid's going down, I'm gonna have my way with him, whatever. And I went over there, and they're on to me. Now, this is another one of these alcoholic moments I like to talk about, because I knew they were on to me. They saw me in the store a half hour earlier. I stunk of booze. I was wearing a down jacket and these big boots, which probably doesn't look so bad around here. But in Phoenix, Arizona, where it's 110 degrees, when it's 70 degrees out Fahrenheit, that doesn't look right. So anyways, I put the bottle of whiskey back, the second one I was going to steal, and all I had to do was walk out the door, go back to dude's apartment, and get molested. right before I was about to leave, I had this moment of just stinging pride. Was like, I just got to steal something. So I grabbed a bottle of eye drop, shoved down my pants real quick, thinking nobody's going to see me and try and get out the store. They tackle my ass. I get pinned down on the sidewalk, getting a fight with the store manager and the bag boy. Off to jail I go again. Now, at this point, I've abused every relationship I have had. I've been kicked out of every single high school I've been in. I'm a ward of the state of Arizona. I'm a loser, drug addict, fuck-up who can't even remember how to multiply, divide, or subtract. And I begin to suspect, but seriously doubt, I might have a problem. Maybe. You know? So I called the priest in, and I said, what's the Bible say there about, you know, drugs and alcohol? And he alluded to some demon spirit this and evil that. And I was like, okay, thanks. And he went on his way. And I remember I got out in a technicality because I think they beat my ass too hard when I was getting out of the store. But I remember hitting the streets. And when I was on the streets, I was like, you know, I knew I didn't want to fuck up anymore. I knew I didn't want to make any more mistakes. I knew I wanted my freedom. I knew I didn't want to be the person I was becoming. And I couldn't stop it. It felt like I was trying to hold a truck from rolling downhill. It was like, I mean, I was just, it just felt so hard to do. And I heard about a party that started at like 11 or 10. I got there at 7 p.m. And I started drinking by the time 11 o'clock out there, or 2,300 hours, as you like to say it. I was completely drunk. And somebody came along with a bunch of speed, and I said, hell yeah, give me that. And I took some speed. I'm not a speed freak either. I never wanted to get too far up. I always wanted to stay down and keep it mellow because it was already high strung, as you've probably already seen. But so I remember looking for a job at like 1 a.m., you know, going to stores. Hey, can I get an application? Look for a job, trying to get my life together. Really trying to do good here, yeah. And I get home that night, and I'm sitting there on the edge of the bed. I'm like, I feel good, feel better. Got a lot done, yeah. And being the regular puker that I am, I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get to sleep is if I start puking. So I went to the bathroom and started to throw up, and I couldn't stop throwing up for some reason. It wasn't the first time that had happened, but I literally threw up all night, right up until the morning. And I remember my mom coming in, and she's standing over me like this, and it's like the piss-soaked bowl my brother and I share. And it feels good on my face because it's cold. I don't care anymore. And you know, you're close to the ground. You're all sweaty and shitty from puking all the time. The cold porcelain feels good on the face. I don't care if there's piss all over it. It felt good. So I look up at my mom. She's looking down at me. I said, Mom, call St. Luke's. I'm going in. And she had been trying to kind of coax me to go to some rehab for a while. And I didn't really know what that meant. But all I knew is that, you know, I was willing to try something. So I went to this hospital, and I remember checking in there, and I was 6 feet tall, 135 pounds, and I was wearing, you know, camouflage pants and a horizontally striped shirt, and I thought I looked really good, you know. And, you know, and when I got in there, they showed me some real basic things. They showed me, you know, how to eat and how to get up in the morning. And they started talking about how to do meditation, how to talk to other people, and all this other stuff. So, you know, when I got out, you know, I was in rehab for like 3 months. All I did was eat and work out and do what they said for 3 months. And I came out of there, I was 6 foot, 285 pounds. And all I did, I got really kind of, I became a real menace to society. And when I got out, my dad and I'd like to tell you, my first year of sobriety, everything was great. And everything just went well. And it's always been a joyride ever since. Complete bullshit, you know. I got more fist fights with my dad in my first year of sobriety than I did the whole time I was drinking, you know. And he would say something to me, and I'd say something to him, and the old behavior was still there. You hear the saying in AA all the time, or in programs all the time, you know, what do you get when you get a sober horse thief? You know, still a horse thief, you know. And I didn't know how to act differently, you know, and that took time. But the thing that made the difference for me is I started to get into the steps of the program. As outlined in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they really helped me. And I think any of the steps outlined in any of the other programs are helpful as long as you do them. That's the key. It's not, oh, are those steps right enough for me? Bullshit. It's whether or not you're going to actually do the work is the story. You know? It doesn't matter on theory or this person looks like they're really doing a good program, so I'm going to hang out there. Maybe their good program will spill over to me. Bullshit. Doesn't work like that. You know, you have to do the work in my experience. So I got the really cool sponsor to have in my area at the time. He was like the tough guy. Everybody wanted him to have a sponsor, but he wasn't the right sponsor for me because he fired me for yelling at him. Because like I said, you know, I'm accustomed to violence. I'm accustomed to getting really, really, angry and I had a really short fuse. And then I got another sponsor and his name was Dan Clement. And Dan was a big Chuck Chamberlain fan, and Chuck Chamberlain historically was more of a man of foresight in the program. He was more of a man of like, okay, let's apply this, the steps and the AA, or let's say the program to your life and let the results speak for themselves. Where my other sponsor was more about, let's control all of your behavior and try and get you to work the steps and we'll keep controlling all of your behavior. And that wasn't working for me because I was like, you know, I'm going to kick somebody's ass if you keep trying to control my behavior. I don't like that. you know, he got me through the steps, and I would meet with my sponsor like every week or every 2 weeks, and I would just unload on the guy. I'd be like, blah, 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 this bitch, blah, 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 I'm not going to get laid ever again, blah, 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 this sucks, blah, 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 blah. And I went over a year and didn't get any ass, I might add, in Alcoholics Anonymous, not by choice, because I was just so irritating and hyper that nobody wanted to give me any. One girl offered it up. She was like, after like a 10 minutes with me, she's like, no, no. So it was horrible, but that was the truth of it, you know. But Dan got me through the steps, and what that gave me was a primary purpose, and that gave me some hope, you know. And I was going to these big book meetings, too, and I want to just make, you know, mention on that, because when I go to meetings that are in the text or they're in the basic text of AA, for me, AA or maybe it's NA or C or whatever you're doing, but something where you're reading about the solution, the common solution applied to the problem at hand, I was able to find hope and direction there. You know, and so one day I got in a fist fight with my dad and I grabbed my big book. And I'll tell you what, I'd like to tell you I was trying to be like some people in the room, maybe a learned scholar, but the truth is this, is that I was a complete idiot, you know, and the only book I was reading was the basic text of AA, you know, and because I was going to a lot of book studies, and they would do things like talk about the book, talk about their life experience, and they talk about how they applied the solution to the life, and I'd go, oh, okay, I get it. So, you know, got in this fist fight with my dad. I went down to the park. I was all pissed off. I started reading my book because that actually made me feel better. And I read in the book, we don't want to squander away hours that are worthwhile fighting. And I was like, I get that. I understand that. I went back home and I said to Dad, I said, Pops, I'm not going to fight you anymore because I'm squandering away hours that are worthwhile fighting you. He's like, okay. Now, I'd like to tell you this, is that I never had another fight with my dad after that. Not one single physical altercation. Now, he got pissed off at me, and I got mad at him a few times, but we never hit each other again. You know, and that's because I finally understood in principle and in application what that line meant in the book, and I could apply it to my life. And the thing is like, I want to make a mention of this, too, is like that experience isn't a singular point of perspective. That's a common point of perspective reflected by all of AA, or all of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a society. So when I'm reading what's in the book, I'm not just reading one person's experience, I'm reading a collective opinion about people's experience based on a large spectrum. I didn't understand that for a long time. I just thought it was, that's the book, this is me, and we're equals. You know, no, I'm not an equal, because I don't have that common experience to reflect on. That's the truth. So when he died, I was a good son to him. You know, and when he died, I was a good friend to him. And I could treat him like, you know, a man. And he could treat me like a friend. And that took a lot of work. And more work on the steps and working through inventories and my resentments and all that shit than direct work on him. And that's been my experience overall in AA. It's like, you know, I've never, you know, if I go, I hate your guts. My solution isn't necessarily to go, all right, I'm going to go try and fix my relationship with you. No, my solution is take a look at why I dislike something or somebody and figure out, is the problem about me? You know, and try and attack and look at it from that perspective. And if I do that, I gain insight, you know, and I gain a genuine change in my behavior and the foundation of who I am, instead of just becoming, you know, a guy that seeks to fix one small problem and let the rest of my life unfold into a mess. You know, I'd like to tell you that all of AA for the last 20-plus years has been great, but that'd be a total lie. And I want to talk about some of the struggles for a minute, too, because, you know, I did eventually get laid, which was nice. You know, and I have made money, and I have had better jobs, you know, and I'm here today as a result of the fact, you know, I do work my ass off in my professional life, and it treats me pretty well. But you know, you're talking about a guy that couldn't put a sentence together. You're talking about a guy who couldn't add and subtract. You know, does okay for himself today. You know, but at about, I don't know, 11 years of sobriety, maybe 10, I got really self-righteous. You know, I got really full of myself. I thought, I'm doing AA the right way, and you fucking idiots don't know nothing. And I would be really condescending and take great comfort in my self-righteousness. Now, my mom, I mentioned before, was going to AA, and she decided not to. Why? Because she got resentful at somebody and decided she didn't want to be a part of this AA thing because she resented an individual. And instead of me giving her the right to make that choice on her own and learn her own lessons, I decided I was going to be Mr. Condescending AA guy that was going to mandate to her what she should do and go back to AA and all this other shit. Well, I'd like to tell you that, you know, our relationship got better, but it didn't. My mom died of cancer very suddenly at about right around 11 years of sobriety. And the thing is that it's always hard for me to talk about this because I was right in the middle of another big inventory because I figured, you know, I don't want to get in a situation in my life where I become really uncomfortable again, because there has literally been a time in my sobriety where I became homeless in sobriety because I was too defiant and too lazy and too uncomfortable to do anything worthwhile. And I became so just embedded into my discomfort that I couldn't do anything. Come on through. It's all right. Yeah. I got to a point in my sobriety where, I couldn't make any moves, and I got really depressed, and then I started compromising my honesty for what I thought I wanted or needed. And then I got myself in a position where I decided that, you know, AA is the problem, the program's the problem, these fucking people, I hate your guts, and I stopped going. And I got really, really far out there, and I almost drank, and that was at about 7 years of sobriety. And the only reason I got back wasn't because somebody came through. There wasn't like this big intervention team of my friends that came through the door and said, "We're going to get you back, bro." You know, nothing like that happened. I went to visit my brother, and I got off the plane, and I looked so bad, he thought I had been drinking. And I sat down on the edge of the couch, and I asked myself a question, am I still willing to go to any lengths to be sober? And I said, yeah, I am. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back to AA and resumed my seat, which works for this guy, which works for Matt H., which is sitting in the front row where I can pay attention, because I'm the kind of asshole that gets distracted all the time. So I like the message coming in right here and clear. But that's me. It's not for everybody. I got plenty of friends to stay sober in the back row. More power to them. But, fast forward back to 11 years. When my mom died, I wasn't a good friend to her, and I wasn't a good son to her, and I wasn't a good AA member to her, because I was self-righteous, and I was unkind, I didn't have any compassion within me, and I learned a really, really hard lesson. That also marked a turning point in my sobriety, where I started doing a lot more meditation and prayer, and if I could say anything all that's worthwhile here today, you know, if you got parents or brothers and sisters, don't take the relationships for granted. You know, I did with my mom, and she died suddenly. I never had a chance to tell her I was sorry, or I was wrong, or Mom, I love you, or Mom, I was an asshole. Or more important than that, I could give her a couple of years where I could be a good son to her, you know, rather than just a bunch of cheap talk. And that was hard. Let me fast forward to like 18 years of sobriety. Boy meets girl on AA campus. Imagine that. And I'm in love with some insane girl in AA. You know, she's like, "Oh, I'm an alcoholic." "No, I'm not." "Yes, I am." "No, I'm not." "Yes, I am." And I'm like, "Oh, fuck, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I still love you. I'm going to make this baby work." And so, much to my dismay, I'm given this halfway house, sober living guy, rides to meetings. This is the same guy I was screwing my girlfriend at the time. And I just went through a really hard knock in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was like, "What the fuck am I doing here?" You know, I got really heartbroken. I got really betrayed by some people that were really close to me in AA. And I just want to say this: is that, you know, we are all trying to get better. The well ship did not land here. You know, this room full of sick, crazy people, and I had some really lofty expectations on people. Not to say it's an excuse to be an asshole. However, it's not for me to be unrealistic about the group of people that I'm trying to deal with. And that was a really, really hard time in my sobriety. It took me a couple of years to get my head out of my ass on that, because I was terribly heartbroken. But I did. And today, that guy is in prison, but I have written him a letter letting him know that we're good. And if I ever see him again, you know, you don't have to worry. We're cool. And I've since amended my relationship with the ex. I don't really want to have anything to do with her crazy ass. However, I don't want any beef between us, and that feels good inside of me. But that didn't happen quickly, you know. For all you relationship experts, like, I'm gonna run right out and fix that shit. Maybe I'll get laid at the side. That doesn't work, you know. That doesn't work. I mean, I've tried it, and it's happened, but it still sucks. You know, I want to tell you a story about willingness, and I like to talk about this because there was a woman who really put me to the test. I'm asking me a question about, are you willing to go to any lengths in your sobriety? Her name is Biker Vicky. And I like to mention Biker Vicky because she was like literally leather chaps, you know, riding around in the desert, skanky, full of bugs, and, you know, in her teeth and her hair and shit from riding a bike. And she would get up there and just yell at people from the podium. And when I was early in rehab, I was in the back row with all my friends. There was room like three times as long as this. We're in the back row, and we're eating candy bars and fucking around and not paying attention. And she's like, I want to ask you punks in the back row something. And we're like, yeah. And she's like, yeah, you guys back there making all the noise. And we're like, okay, well, you know what? Oh, are you willing to go to any lengths to be sober and clean? It was an NA meeting, in fact, I think it was. We're like, yeah, sure, we are. Well, are you sure about that? Because you're making a lot of noise back there fucking with my sobriety. And we're like, yeah, we're sure about that, bitch. What about it? You know? and she goes, well, let me ask you this then. And we're literally up out of our seats. She's like, are you willing to suck a dick for sobriety? And we're like, oh, God. We all sat back down. Now, for anybody who's new in the program, nowhere in the basic text or any other piece of literature today does it say you have to do anything like that for sobriety. However, Biker Vicky got our attention. So more importantly, she got my attention. So I moved to the front row because I didn't want to have that experience. And for me, that's a poignant and important lesson that I try and take with me today. It's like, you know, am I still willing to go to any lengths to be sober? Because that literally has been the thing that my sobriety has hinged on at times in my life. Am I still willing to go to any lengths to do this? You know, and I get up and I go to the meeting. You know, the last few years of my life, and I got about 4 minutes, right? Okay. Last years of my life have been really full, you know. I'm not one who has been, I got my number of years sober. I got some money in the bank. Everything's going cool. No, you know, I'm about doing things. I'm very active in my life. And I'm all about, you know, looking forward and continuing to show up and do things. You know, me being here this week is a result of that. I mean, last year I was in Stockholm with a bunch of people for the EuriPa conference that's happening in Dublin, and I'm going there next. And it's not like, you know, somebody died and left me a lot of money. I got to make this money to go on these trips and do this shit, but I do it. And then last year I met this crazy guy from the Ukraine. His name is Ilya, and Ilya came up to me and says, hey, come to Russia, work steps, I need help. And I remember I was like, Ukraine? Like, sure, I don't know. I don't know anything about the Ukraine, but I'd like taken some time off work. I really didn't have an excuse not to go. And he's like, you're a U.S. citizen. I said, yeah. He goes, oh, you need a visa. I'm like, oh, fuck. And then I had this little intuitive thought popped in my head. Check on that. So I checked online. It says, you haven't needed a visa since 2007. So I called him. I saw him. And I said, hey, man, you don't need a visa. He's like, oh, perfect. Will you go then? I'm like, okay, I guess I go then. And then so I wired a guy money that I didn't even really know in another country for bus tickets and all this shit. And then my buddy Morton back there, he says, hey, I want to go. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I want to go. So he's like, all right, fuck it. And he's going to meet me in Kiev. So we meet in Kiev. We were supposed to meet in Kiev. He misses his plane. And I end up on some crazy train ride. It's like a million degrees, a million, like 90% humidity the whole time. You ever want to lose some weight, you just got to go to the Ukraine in a heat wave. You wait. But I had like this incredible adventure in my life, you know, and that happened recently, you know. And that's because I was willing to be of service, you know, because somebody asked for help, you know, and I really didn't have an excuse not to go, and I went. You know, and it was such a cool thing. I mean, literally, it's one of the best memories of my life right now. And I feel like right now I'm building another one of those best memories with you. You know, and today when I meditate, and I do this every day, I spend a little time almost every day doing some prayer meditation. Not because I want to be better than my average AA, it's because it's important to me. You know, and because I want to grow a little bit more inside. And when I got to AA, or when I got to my program, which is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I thought, if I can just get laid, and I can just get a job, and I can just get, you know, maybe a new bicycle and a skateboard, everything's going to be good, you know. And I never did get that new bicycle, but I did get a skateboard, and eventually I got laid. But point is this, is that I was really short-sighting myself. And I've discovered that, you know, I used to think that this whole life thing was about getting the outside of your life fixed up, and then you'll feel good on the end. And the program tells me a different story. If we take care of the spiritual, you know, everything else unfolds from there. So I figured that out through the steps, that, you know, it's an inside-out job. And then I used to be real limited, because I used to go, okay, I'm going to work the program, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get the results, which I've gotten before. But I used to say, okay, this is what I've seen, this is what I know, and this is where it's going to lead me to. And now I'm of the perspective that I do, it's more like an inside all perspective, where I do the work and I don't worry about where it's going to lead me to. I might have some framework based on past experience, but for the most part, I'm going to let it unfold as the universe sees fit. And I'm not going to be, try not to be afraid. You know, when I was driving around in the Ukraine into oncoming traffic, yeah, I was afraid, okay? I was some crazy priest driver that says he was an AA. Hell, I don't even know to this day. But I was afraid. But the point is this, that I got out there and experienced life. I didn't let anything hold me back. And I say to you and anybody in this room, you know, I don't care if you've been sober, you know, 10 minutes or 10 years, you know? It's like you can hit restart on this program anytime you want. You can always dive deeper. You can always do more. And for me, it's been a great experience. And I invite you to do what the program suggests. You know, and whether you're an AA or NA or CA, they're all built around the same basic framework. But that's work. It's not easy. It's simple, but it's not easy. So ask your higher power, whatever it might be, to help you get there and do the work. You know, and you'll have a great life. It's an equation that works. I'll say one final thing, and then I'm shutting up, is that when I got really heartbroken and screwed up in the head at 18 years of sobriety, I thought about leaving AA. I thought, I can't be here anymore. These people are killing me. I was killing myself, but I thought they were killing me. And I realized that, you know, if I'm going to leave, I need to develop a way of life that works. And that was a turning point for me, because I realized, you know, I am in the way of life that works. This way of life is a way of life that is highly effective for me as an individual. If you don't want to be in AA, fine, get out there. Or if you don't want to be in your program, fine, get out there. But you're going to have to develop a way of life that works anyways. It's a constant. If you don't develop a way of life that works, you're fucked. You know what? And the thing is that I realize that this is something that does work for me and will work for me if I can get my own agenda out of the way. And it's been really fulfilling, and I'll continue to do it. If anybody wants my help, I'm available to help. You know, anybody that I've worked with in the past that knows the way through the steps, they can help. And they're armed with the program's information. Not me, but the program. That's what's most important. Thanks for listening. That's all.